The Bane Free Radio Hour.
Welcome to the Bane Free Radio Hour. This is Bane editor David F. Shahrirad. As I'm sure many of our listeners know, the science fiction literary world and the Bane Books family lost a member on February 20th of this year. Steve Miller, the co-author with his wife Sharon Lee of the groundbreaking, genre-defining Liaden Universe series, died at his home in Maine. Today, we're taking a look back at some highlights from past Bane Free Radio Hour interviews with Mr. Miller. The topics covered, while centered on the Liaden Universe books, are far-ranging. The interviews were conducted by Griffin Barber, and Mr. Miller was joined by his wife and collaborator, Sharon Lee.
Hello, my name is Griffin Barber. I'm your host today for Bane Free Radio Hour. Today we're talking with Sharon Lee and Steve Miller, authors of an enormous body of work, the Liaden Universe, as it's most commonly known. But just to talk about them first, Sharon Lee and Steve Miller have been one of the most prolific writing teams of any era, furnishing more than 20 novels and a number of short stories, novellas, and short novels containing additional content for fans of their Liaden Universe. It's been over the last 30 plus years that they've been working together. Both have written other well-received works independent of their shared universe, but one gets the impression that the Liaden Universe is something of a joyful obsession for both authors. This is manifestly a good thing for fans, as we are here to discuss no less than the 24th novel, Fair Trade, forthcoming from Bane Books on May 3rd, 2022. Hello and welcome back, Sharon and Steve.
Thank you very much. Hello.
So as we've done before, I have this kind of cool question that I like to ask. What is the coolest thing about Fair Trade for each of you?
Coolest thing about Fair Trade? Go, Steve.
I think the thing that's cool about Fair Trade is that it kind of tumbled directly out of the the Jethry story that came before. And we Jethry was one of the fun things that happened to us when somebody said to us once upon a time, gee, I need a story. And Sharon said, I have this character who's been in the back of my head trying to get a scene. And so we did a little short story and it was called The Balance of Trade. And it turned out that that story wasn't finished. And it ended up three or four years later being a novel. And it followed through. There was another novel that followed that. And the whole idea of somebody who wanted to be a trader, we wanted to follow it more closely than we had with the other story arcs. So it just
didn't have legs.
Yeah, for a kid that we were going to use for about 6,000 words and let him go, a tremendous amount.
And then kind of getting into a little bit of the nitty gritty, there's the scene where they're forming a circuit. I'm a huge fan of like collective consciousness things and that kind of thing. So just kind of wondering if you've already worked out whether or not that circuit increases their processing power or their intelligence, or if it's just for sharing data amongst the participants so that they have a smooth flow of information rather than having to speak about it.
It's a difficult concept, but if you look at meetings where people are doing where us people, you know, currently where people start sharing ideas in a hurry, this idea, what about this, where you do brainstorming. Well, what happens? Did everybody in the circuit get smarter, or is it the idea of the sharing automatically, or the sharing can pull in these different things and make the result of a brainstorming session better and stronger? Well, it's part of that, and it's part of it we can't go into because we have stories ahead.
Is this more of an exploration of the trade stuff in this arc than we've seen previously? Is this the first time we're seeing a Congress?
Oh, yes. Yes, there's the way trading has been shown previously has largely been ship to ship or person to person. We've seen Sean doing some trading. We've seen them In a couple of cases, we've seen, I have to remember all the names of the ships. There's the Balrog, having come back from doing some trading. We've seen the different, but those have always been seen as taking place in an area where trade goes on, but without seeing the necessary encumbrances of how do you make money flow? How do you do that kind of thing? So it's a little bit of that kind of fill in. We can't get too involved with it. I will tell you that very early on in the Leiden universe, we had people asking us, well, how much is a contra worth exactly?
Right.
And that's very, very much like saying, how much is a dollar worth exactly? Right.
How much is a dollar worth in Maine and how much is a dollar worth in California? They're
exactly.
Two totally different sums.
Absolutely. Well, and so that was it. That's interesting to me because I was taken in by the whole conference. The Congress was really cool. And it rang to me as like, this is something that's going on before, because you have characters who have participated in previous ones, but that everyone seemed to have certain expectations of what this was about. So it was, again, really well presented, and that I felt like it was something you guys had talked about before. And, you know, you weren't blowing by details. You were just providing, yeah, this is the way it is. And the characters are all kind of comfortable with it. And it's, while it's Jethry's first Congress for this particular type of thing, or I think it is his first Congress, right?
Right.
Congress. He was a baby during the second one. The first
one. And he's, you know, everybody's telling, well, you know, the pre-Congress, and then there's the pre-pre-Congress, which immediately resonated for me for like the bigger conventions, right?
Yep.
You know, the first few days of the convention, or before the convention, it's always everybody's sneaking in and, you know, trying to have dinner or whatever with their friends. And then it kind of goes up and it picks up in pace and intensity as you go along.
For the real event, yes.
Yeah, and that was one thing you conveyed really, really well about this Congress was that was going on. I guess that's a big spoiler, but it's kind of one of the main things that's going on, right?
And anybody who's at the science fiction convention knows this. Actually, Jethry, in Balance of Trade, Jethry went from unwanted son of a small Terran trade ship, a loop ship, to the apprentice of a Leiden trader. He's learning simultaneously how to be a trader and how to be a Leiden, or at least how to deal with Leidens, so that he doesn't offend them, so he can trade with them. In Trade Secret, he needs to recover a birthright from his father's side of the family and decide what to do with that birthright, which will not offend either Leidens or Loopers. In this one, Jethry is almost having to learn how to be a politician. He needs to get some stuff done, and it's really serious, life-threatening stuff. And he's got to trade on a whole different level.
And there's the additional level of he's mostly dealt with trading Leidens and trading Terrans and Loopers. And now all of a sudden he's having to deal with the concept of people who live on planets because they want to.
Who would do that?
And so was there anything that you, as you were working on it, that you were kind of like, well, I'm going to need to tackle this further down the road, or that you were like really excited about and were kind of, I kind of want to cram it in?
But we have one of the problems, again, because we have brought the Norbears in, and because we have brought in a certain amount of trade, we've now got to be able to show why there's not always a smooth transition from, well, this was 200 years ago or whatever. Why isn't it that much better now? But the way the universe works is not always straightforward, and I hate to use the word I learned way back when, but there's kind of a dialectic going on here where one side says this is what we're going to do, and the other side says no, it's not, and they said yes it is, we're doing it, and then the other side says well ho ho and pushes back again. So that goes on, and that has something that's always been in the books too, is the fact that progress isn't always isn't straightforward. Just because you've managed to do it this time, you don't always stay where you were. You have to go back and do it again in some cases.
Yeah, reinvent the wheel.
As Steve and I were talking about this morning, cold changes. We've been doing this for a really long time. And the first cold thing was that we were going to go against this. We're going back to the 80s, the 1980s, way back. We were going to have characters that had, in a science fiction book, relationships and ongoing commitments, which we got kind of tired of, or at least I was kind of tired of the sci-fi hero who went it alone, you know. And so that started out being a very cool thing. But as you move on, other things get cool, or they get cooler. The characters are still a joy. And the tree is still a joy. But what's really cool about the universe is the universe keeps opening up. The further we go in, it's not constraining us, it's letting us go wider.
And I think that the fact is that we started off with the help, in effect, of say Roger Zelazny. Mm-hmm. Because I knew Roger, he was a friend of mine, and he had sold 7 books at once when he sold the initial series for Amber. And we were interested in the idea of being able to go at pace and not have to get everything done in one place. And then we took it that next step. We went from wanting to write a series to wanting to write in a universe, which would allow us to do side things and stuff. And we saw that pretty early. Partly that too was probably from, we knew Anne McCaffrey and her writing, and she was doing a little bit of that kind of thing. Because otherwise at that point, most stories were written, most science fiction novels were standalones. And it was very rare to get a trilogy. And here we were positing when we started off that we were going to write at least 7 or 8 books, and that they would be all in the universe, but they wouldn't necessarily be presented serially. So we were able to work with that from the beginning, which meant we didn't have to shove everything into this story right now. We started when we had already been writing a few things together accidentally. Sharon and I were both sort of in the opportunity pool, having been the opportunity pool being what happened when you were working for people and they laid you off or whatever. And so we've both been in the opportunity pool, and Sharon got a job and had been working on a story. And for several days, the story stayed in the typewriter. This is back in the day of manual typewriters where you roll the paper in and get like that. And I went upstairs and it wasn't changing. And finally I gave up and called her and said, "Sharon, I think I know where this story goes. Can I write it?"
And I said, "Yes, you can. But if I don't like it, I reserve the right to not accept what you've done." And he went, "Deal."
And so that's how we started writing together at all. The Liaden universe itself started appearing one day when I was off running a chess tournament. I was a professional chess tournament director for a while. And I came home and Sharon said, "I've got a novel here." And I looked at the line and said, "No, you don't have a novel. This is a series." And we sat down and did it like that. And that was a thrill too, but we'd had some of Roger's experience that he had talked to me about how do you put something together like this? Because then still at that point, people were thinking trilogy, wow. And here we sat down and said, okay, 7 books.
Then at one blow.
We do deal with people who are on the fringes a lot. And one of the reasons we do is, as with the Lux, things happen to people who are on the fringes. People who are doing the same old, same old, same old and have no connection with the fringe are not as likely to have an adventure. And this is one of the reasons when people say to us, have an adventure. And I think, whoa, no. We've seen adventures, thank you. But the point here for Veppel is that, and that story is again, he was first mentioned in the very first book.
Agent Strang Ambassador, yes, he was, and Agent of Change.
And his existence was mentioned 23 books before we got to him.
Right.
he had been actually in a couple of spots. And what had happened is that, again, Sharon had had some times, and she had started, we had both been interested in Veppel and had tried to work him in some other locations.
Out of Honor had started as part of Accepting the Lance. And I had written some of it and then went, no, it doesn't belong in this book. And I gave it to Steve and said, you know, maybe a short story. Can you see where it goes?
Yeah. And what we had been dealing with, of course, is the strain, if you want to talk of the societies where the X-Strang are always the bad guys. There's never anything else, but they'd been seen never as anything else but the bad guys, except that through the universe over time, one or two have been brought in and another one or two have been brought into the story. So people are saying, hey, you know, these guys aren't, you know, they're not all that bad necessarily. They can't be exactly that bad.
So I think you might recall from the last time we did this that I have the cool question. From previous interviews, what is the coolest thing about the salvage right for each of you?
Well, for me, it was the energy of writing the book. It was a fun book to write. And of course, authors have very strange ideas about what's fun. the rush of writing a book that wants to be written is a gift. And the characters in this book in particular were just awesome. The chemistry was beautiful between the entire cast.
And I think it was cool to us because the characters and this entire story were very fresh. They were a lot of the characters were in the universe, but not interacting necessarily with each other. And all of a sudden, here it was that these people had to do this right now.
So it wasn't like they had to make it work.
And so it wasn't like it was part of the longer story arc that we had been working with over time. It all just fell in together to run.
Neat. So from the afterword, there's a real world story behind how the Tensori Light came to occupy some headspace for the two of you. Care to share with your fans what that story was?
when we went to the ocean the first time when we were in Maine, we took with us a weather radio, and because it was supposed to also have FM, AM, and all of that, but it turned out that in Old Orchard Beach you couldn't get anything else but the weather radio where we were staying. So we had the weather radio on in the back, and the weather radios, when they're serving an entire coastal region, will tell you there is the weather at Jodrell's Bank, and weather here, the weather there. But we kept coming up with the...
And they have buoys and lighthouses that report in, and so you know where the action is.
And they circulate through, I guess they repeat a dozen of them, the top of Mount Washington, and then the rest of them. And it turned out that there was a place that kept coming in, Matinicus Rock is not reporting.
And it sounded so attitudinal, like, you know, you can't make me report.
And so over time, we would be listening, and there would go Matinicus Rock. And the last time, last time we went down, we took our same weather radio, and there it was again, that two out of three times, Matinicus Rock was not reporting. And now Sharon can...
Well, Matinicus Rock obviously is a real thing. If you look at the beginning of the book where we acknowledge the reasons we wrote the book. One of the reasons is for Abby Burgess and Matinicus Rock Light Station. Matinicus Rock Light Station is this huge chunk of granite in the middle of the ocean, with two lighthouses, one on each side, and the keeper's farm in the middle. It is just, the house is granite. And way back in the 18-somethings, Abby lived there with her dad, her elder brother, her mom, her sick mom, and two younger sisters. And one day, dad went to Rockland for supplies. Elder brother was out fishing, and a storm came up. The storm of storms came up, and Abby quickly realized that they were not going to make it if they stayed in the house. So she moved her family into one of the lights and ran out to get the chickens, came back in, a big roller came over, and when it retreated, the house was gone.
Wow.
And for 28 days.
For 28 days, this young woman who was barely...
She was 16.
She was a teenager. She ran the light by herself.
The lights did not go out. This is the other.
She ran the light by herself. It took them 28 days before they could get anybody else out to her. They were eating, as Sharon was doing some research, they were eating an egg a day.
Good thing she saved the hens.
And they had cornmeal. Part of it had been chicken food, but it wasn't. And so they had something to eat. Of course, they did have, and even water was a problem because they were in the middle of the ocean.
Yes.
And so they managed to make it work. So all of this urgency also helped.
Define Tensori Light. The attitude and the whole hostile environment.
Right. The events of Salvage Right seem to tie up threads from a variety of earlier novels. And you kind of touched on that, I think, when you said it kind of cried out to be written. Mm-hmm. But the story is as much about family, both chosen and born into, as anything else. Do either or both of you come from large families or kinship groups, or have you added to those?
I come from a fairly large family, and it was a complex family. Back when people weren't divorcing, my grandmother had gotten divorced, and then later on my mother got divorced, and so there were some remarriages there, and that happened on both sides of the family. So I think the first time Sharon came to visit for an event, they kept saying, "Sharon doesn't say anything, why not?" But she was in a room where there were like five uncles and
all of them holding forth.
Five uncles and plus my brothers and my sister and et cetera, et cetera. So it was always very active. For our 4th of July picnic, we would end up with about 200 people for the 4th of July picnic. And this kind of an event, we could hold a sudden picnic on a weekend and we'd end up with 50 people just say, "Hey, why don't you come on over?" So it was that kind of a family event thing going.
So again, I touched on this pretty strongly already, but I enjoyed how the crews and ships came out of the woodwork to assist the Tensori Light's crew. Certainly there were opportunities for improving relations and such, but it seemed to me that the crews were there simply because it was the right thing to do, or at least some of them were. Did this spring from your personal experience, from the con scenes, from the Steve, from your family kind of thing, or was it a hopeful glimpse?
I have two quick examples. One, at one point, Sharon and I were in a situation where we decided we needed to move. And having determined that we were going to move, we found out that if we moved within the next 12 hours, we didn't have to pay the next month's rent. We weren't responsible for the next 3 years worth of a housing contract. We could get out of it all. We had 12 hours to move. And I called up one of my brothers and I said to my brother, "Ron, can we get a little help here? Do you have any ideas?" He said, "Sure." And about 3 hours later, we were mostly out of the house.
We were moved. He brought a crew. They brought boxes. They started at this cabinet and they just packed stuff.
They brought boxes. They brought several trucks. He had lived and worked with a number of people who had who had that kind of equipment around. And he lived among, at that point, among a group of people who suddenly had to move sometimes, and they knew how to do it.
They even brought the neighbor cat, who had jumped into the trunk by accident, so we had to bring that one back.
But yeah, and the same thing at conventions. There was, for an example, one would be SunCon many years ago in Florida, where the hotel went into bankruptcy as the convention was starting.
Wow.
Many things that were supposed to be going on weren't able to go on. There were sections of the hotel we couldn't use anymore.
It was dark.
There were rooms that we couldn't use because of the new people coming in said, And in essence, I was lucky enough to be part of the art show that got put together probably in about 2.5 or 3 hours. By the assembled East Coast Art Show people who all knew what to do, but this isn't how it was going to be done. And they said, okay. So sort of a straw boss happened.
We can have an art show and people can look at the art.
And that's what they focused on. They put it together. It wasn't as pretty as it might've been, but it was an art show and it all happened. And again, it was all dragged together for people. Yeah, I know how to do this. He knows how to get him over here. So, yeah.
So which characters or character from Salvage Right would you most want to meet?
Met them all. Like them mostly. I'd like to hang out with Clarence.
And I think maybe Joyita. Because Joyita is...
He's a smart ass, he's
a wiseacre. And you can hardly get more self-made than Joyita in a lot of ways. Started off as a stupid little
program
on the side that people kept saying, here you can do this too, and grew into a functioning person. And that's a hard one. Yeah, so okay. Joyita.
My personal would be, I think, is probably Katie.
Okay. I can see that.
It was neat to see that development was very cool, and it's not to give anything away, it's very cool. So which character do you want to avoid like the plague, and why?
Oh, Director Formine, big woman. Don't want to have anything to do with her.
And we've had people ask us before the question of who would you like to go to lunch with, who would you want to go to dinner with, or that right. kind of thing. Right. And we've tried to explain from time to time that our what people think of as the lead characters in the entire thing, Valcon and Miri. I really don't want to be where Valcon and Miri are, because
something big will happen.
The chance of something happening seems to be right there. This is why we had Theo being called a nexus of violence. I probably really wouldn't want to meet the uncle.
But his sister turned out well.
And I mean, so
talk about a man scientist you love.
So really probably the uncle I would not want to meet, but that's because I know the circumstances regarding the uncle.
Right. Yeah, that, for me, we for 20 years in law enforcement, they call that, you know, individuals like that, they call them Captain Clusters. Because no matter where they go, some cluster is about to break out.
Something's going to blow up. Okay, yeah.
So, yeah, I totally get that about Uncle and about those mainline characters. They're pretty likely that you're going to be caught up in something. So unless you're ready to go on an adventure, probably not the best idea. So, which character would you want as an ally?
Well, it depends on what kind of trouble I'm in. Just for general mayhem, I guess Theo.
I was going to say Theo is pretty close. Yeah, Theo, and through Theo, of course, Pashimo these days.
Well, but the only reason that Theo doesn't totally shake the universe to pieces is because she has a competent crew who are willing to say to her, "No, don't do that."
One of the things that's ongoing in the entire series, when you're dealing with Korvaal, is the question of, well, what would you do? And the response from a child who is 8 years old to somebody who is 79, I'd do something.
Something would have to be done. Yes, somebody has to do something. Oh, I guess I'm somebody.
It's the case of if this happens, what will you do? I'll do something. And it's...
But this book has many people with many very strange professions. I mean, we have Signor Vioni, who is a researcher, that's what she likes to be called, and an expert in system architecture and other weird and arcane machines. We have Tolly Jones, who has the very strange profession of mentoring AIs.
And since AIs had previously been illegal, his profession is mentoring people who don't exist.
Right.
So they can be better people.
And he has a reputation as being the best of it. Right. Although they're so.
Hasn't's a good thing to have in a fight.
That's true.
It's an interesting question, but it really does depend on what do I need.
Yeah, for me, it's Tolly.
Is it? Okay.
Because I like the fact that, well, even while he's busy or has his own personal concerns, he's helping everybody else.
He's an interesting character. They're all
interesting. For me, they are certainly, but that's very important. Mm-hmm. Often the best way to help yourself is to help others while you're working through it, right?
Yes.
And so he has this enormous existential threat to himself and to his life. And yet he's still, he literally turns away from whatever it is he's doing to help somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
Remarkable for me. So penultimate question for us today. What, aside from the entertainment value, do you hope readers will carry with them long after reading Salvage Right?
Hope is precious, and we do better when we help each other.
That's that's kind of the way it works, and it's help. We've had so much help in getting our books together, in as I said, being able to called one person up and said, "Get us out of here." We got out of there.
Right.
We were at a convention at one point where Sharon was being bothered by somebody. And we let it know that Sharon is being bothered by this person. And for the entire rest of the convention, there was a crew of people
who ran interference.
Ran interference and made sure that that person didn't come anywhere near, and there was no problem. So those kind of things, the getting help where you need it. And sometimes you have giving help, and you also sometimes need to remember to ask.
Right.
And now we bring you our audiobook serialization of Tinker by Wynn Spencer. Inventor girl genius Tinker lives in a near future Pittsburgh, which now exists mostly in the land of the elves. She runs her salvage business, pays her taxes, and tries to keep the local ambient level of magic down with gadgets of her own design. When a pack of wargs chase an elven noble into her scrapyard, life as she knows it takes a serious detour. Tinker finds herself taking on the Elven Court, the NSA, the Elven Interdimensional Agency, technology smugglers, and a college-minded xenobiologist as she tries to stay focused on what's really important, her first date. Armed with an intelligence the size of a planet, steel-toed boots, and a junkyard dog attitude, Tinker is ready to kick butt to get her first kiss.
Tinker leaned against the glass, eager for her first sight of Pittsburgh. For hours they had sailed over the unending green of Elfin Forest, gently rocked as the Gossamer swam against the headwind. The crew had said that it would take 6 hours, and now at noon, the time of arrival was nearing. Beside her, the navigator had been peering intently through a spyglass, picking out familiar landmarks. "We're here." She scanned the horizon, finding the glitter of a river, guessed it to be the Monongahela, and watched it unravel westward through the forest. There was a clearing in the forest with a cluster of enclaves and a wide field thick with colorful tents, and then more forest and another river. "What's that?"
"Oakland," the navigator said. "Bring her to a slow speed."
"Oakland?" Tinker frowned, studying the onrushing buildings. Faintly, she could see the rim, its barren strip of no man's land, arcing through the forest. Yes, it was the elfin Oakland, but Pittsburgh wasn't there. No human streets, half-empty buildings, skyscrapers or bridges. Just unending forest. "Oh no, it's shut down." "Of course it is," Sparrow said. "We've always thought it as an odd and awkward way of doing a pathway, but that's humans for you." Windwolf shot Sparrow a hard look, which gained a contrite half-bow, and his assistant fleeing. "I am sorry, I had forgotten to check." "It will be back tomorrow." Tinker shoved away her disappointment. They were all but home now. "The enclaves will be full tonight."
"Room will be found."
Windwolf hugged her. His presence distracted her from Pittsburgh's absence to a realization of the date. "We met last shutdown, just 28 days ago. Oh, gods, the last 3 weeks had been the longest in her life. Immortality at this speed was going to drive her nuts."
"Time expands and contracts."
Windwolf kissed her hair.
"Sometimes a day can seem like a second, and sometimes it lasts forever. Certainly the hours that I lay helpless on Earth were the longest I've ever lived."
"Then we're even." Prior to shutdown, all the elves living in Pittsburgh shifted temporarily to either the enclaves or camps at the fairgrounds, thus the collection of bright-colored tents crowding the meadow. Since the fairgrounds doubled as the airfield for the massive airship, it took shouted negotiations, followed by careful maneuvering to accomplish a tethering. While this was being accomplished, Tinker studied the flip side of Pittsburgh, the great circle of forest sent to Earth with startup. Here on Elfhome, there was nothing at the rim but barren land. Back on Earth was a chain-link fence surrounding the forest, a great wall of China done in steel, to keep in dangerous elfin wildlife, and more importantly, keep out unwanted human immigrants. On Earth and in Pittsburgh, EIA patrolled the rim. From the observation lounge, having been politely scooted out for the already complicated tethering, Tinker could see elfin rangers moving through the trees, keeping close to the rim, but scouting for trespassers. The sole building within the forest was the legendary EIA lockup, an ugly, squat cinder block building whose only function was to hold prisoners until startup returned them to Earth. At one time, Tinker lived in fear of it and its polar opposite, the glass castle of EIA headquarters in Pittsburgh. Also from her high vantage point, Tinker could see that someone had managed to do some illegal logging of the virgin forest. The south shore of the Ohio, approximately where the West End Bridge crossed in Pittsburgh, had been stripped bare, although she couldn't imagine how anyone could cut down the trees and get them into the river without heavy equipment. Apparently, the EIA's watch on Earth wasn't as legendary as she'd always heard. Movement directly below caught her eye, and she looked downward. Someone was waving at the Gossamer, a short and plain figure among the tall, elegantly dressed elves. "Oil can," she cried. "Oh gods, what is he doing here?" After waving at her cousin to let him know she saw him, she went to beat on anyone who could get her down to the ground. Minutes later, the elevator dropped her down. The door opened and he was there, waiting, and she pounced on him. "What are you doing here?" She hugged him tightly.
"Waiting for you," he said. "Gods, look at you. You look wonderful."
"I still feel a little dorky in these clothes," she plucked at her skirt. "I had to be acceptable at Omra now, in case I ran into the Queen in some dark hallway." She realized that she was rambling and hugged him again. "What are you doing here?" He grinned.
I just had this feeling that you'd be coming back during shutdown, and I'd been kicking myself for not going with you, so I asked Maynard to get me permission to ride out shutdown on Elfhome. He glanced back at the wall of trees beyond the rim. It was weird watching Pittsburgh vanish, though. I've had this creepy feeling all morning, like it wasn't coming back and I'd be stuck here. I was starting to think I'd made a big mistake. By the very nature of humans and elves, the gate will close while you're alive. She glanced around at the single cluster of enclaves and the handful of tents. No electricity, no computers, and no phones. Oh, gods protect her. She'd go mad.
That was another installment in Wyn Spencer's Tinker, and that's it for the podcast. Thanks as always to Audible.com and podcast theme composer Ruth Judkowitz. And good night, Tony Daniel, wherever you are. This is David F. Shirod coming to you from a soundproof bunker somewhere deep in the heart of Texas. Join us here next week at the hammering heart of science fiction and fantasy, and keep reaching for the stars.